The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If asked to imagine a medieval city, you probably think of Europe or the Middle East. Walled fiefdoms, bustling market stalls, maybe a castle or cathedral or dome of a mosque. You won't likely conjure up pyramids on the floodplains of the Mississippi River, though that is the site of a complex metropolis that was home to as many as 30,000 people in the year 1050, bigger than contemporary Paris or London. By 1400, the population had disappeared, and today archaeologists don't even know what it's called, but use the name Cahokia after the tribe that occupied the city in the 17th century when European explorers rolled through town. So what happened? Annalee Newitz is founder of IO9, former editor-in-chief of Gizmodo, and tech culture editor for Ars Technica. She joined a team of archaeologists digging to find answers about the lost city. Annalee, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I had no idea this even existed. Where exactly is the site?
So it's in southern Illinois, and the main part of the site is in a town called Collinsville, and that's east of East St. Louis. So basically, to get there, you kind of drive through the suburbs and find yourself in a beautiful park.
Well, that's the thing. The land was developed there for farms, you know, built over throughout development. So how much of it was lost?
So it's hard to say for sure how much of the city hasn't been found yet, because every time there's a major freeway project or breaking ground somewhere, especially in East St. Louis, we tend to find more evidence that the city stretched further than we knew. So right now, there's a rather large site that's a UNESCO World Heritage Site in Collinsville. So you can go visit, and there's a visitor's center where you can learn all about the people who lived in Cahokia. But that's just that area that you can visit and you can walk around in is really just the downtown part of the city, where they had a huge central pyramid that today we call Monk's Mound, because some French monks used to live there about 200 years ago. But before that, of course, long ago, about 1,000 years ago, that probably would have been a site where elites in the city would do rituals or might have spoken to the people of the city about new ideas. And so you can visit the downtown, and then all of the rest of the town is kind of underneath East St. Louis, and parts of it are also underneath St. Louis as well.
So you went out and joined the dig yourself with several researchers, and you're talking about the layout of a city that sort of suggests hierarchy and division and centralization. What else do we know about this place that was home to more than 30,000 people, more than London or Paris at the time? So when was it inhabited?
So the area was inhabited continuously for many thousands of years, but it really was just small villages. And then sometime around the year 1000, a new group of people came into the area and started to build mounds. And in fact, there are mound cities throughout the United States, especially in the South and parts of the Midwest. And if you've lived in one of those places, you might have heard of a place called Moundville or Mound City. There's a lot of those. And so this group of people had seen those other mound cities and decided, okay, we're going to build the greatest mound city of all. And it certainly is. I mean, the mounds are enormous. There's dozens of them, and they kind of form a complex pattern. If you can look at the city above, you can sort of see that there's a northwest orientation to the layout of the mounds that's very striking. And what we know is that they probably built the city pretty quickly, that these huge mounds may have been built just on the order of decades, and it was probably a kind of religious revival that inspired the creation of the city. And there's a lot of evidence for that, both from contemporary Native American culture, but also from the kinds of symbols that we find buried there. And it's, again, it's hard, it's was it a religious revival? Was it a kind of political revival? These are the kinds of questions that archaeologists want to answer, but really we need a time machine to know. But it seems clear that what brought people together was a new way of thinking and a new way of organizing their culture. It wasn't like they came together to build cars or to make statues or to trade things. It really wasn't an economic entity so much as it was a kind of spiritual city or political city.
Well, there is a map with some artist renderings accompanying your article, which I would really encourage people to look at. And we'll have all that posted at wordofmouthradio.org. Okay, but how about the things that we do know? What did get uncovered that reveals what the culture there was like?
So we know for sure that these people were farmers, and they were incredibly talented farmers. And this is at a time when, you know, the kinds of farms that you would typically see in Europe would have just been little tiny family plots. And these, the people of Cahokia had vast farms, and they were farming a number of different kinds of, they had maize, but they also had a lot of other starchy seeds. So they were very organized in terms of providing food for all the people that lived there. They were fantastic architects. They knew how to take mud and turn it into these enduring structures that we still have today, these mounds. And they also had religious beliefs that had to do with an upper world and an underworld coming together. And there's a lot of imagery in the pots that they left behind and in figurines that we found that show that people really valued the idea of the upper world, which was full of spirits and thunder and, you know, the land of the sky, and the underworld coming together. The underworld was the land of farming and earth and fish and sea. And so we think of the underworld in the West as being kind of like where demons are. It's like a terrible place. But the underworld for Cahokians was the place of fertility. It was where you grew things and where all of the food was. And so when the upper world and underworld came together, it was very powerful. So there's some hints that maybe part of the reason why people created these mounds, nobody really lived on top of them except for maybe a few elites perhaps, but it was a way of symbolizing the underworld and the upper world coming together in this very special, powerful way. And Cahokia was in an area that was very, very fertile. The land around the city would have been incredibly great for farming. And so it must have seemed to those people like, wow, we've come to this amazing place where stuff just grows like crazy. This must be a kind of blessed place or really special in some way.
Right. With the Mississippi floodplain, the soil would be rich there. But also a lot of evidence of having a sense of the artistic or the decorative. What did you find in that realm?
So there's a lot of, there's a type of pottery called Raimi that comes from Cahokia and actually was so beautiful. It's these really finely made pots that are often covered in a black slip or like a black paint. And then they're carved into them are all of these beautiful images of the underworld and the upper world. You'll see fish, but you'll also see abstract patterns that are just beautiful. And these were so valued, these Raimi pots, that people who visited Cahokia carried them as far as Florida. People would come from far away to visit Cahokia for feasts and then would leave and bring trinkets with them. There's also art of what often gets called a birdman or a hawkman. And it's basically just a person with kind of a hooked nose and wings. And that figure appears throughout the Mississippian area as well during the medieval period. And so we think maybe that was a superhero figure or some kind of, you know, mythical figure, possibly related to contemporary Sioux stories about Red Horn, who is a really awesome superhero who hung out with the gods. But we don't know who that was. We just call him the Birdman. And then, of course, there were all kinds of other pieces of artistic expression that kind of don't really survive because a lot of what they built with was wood. And so we have some hints of how much they might have decorated that wood and what they would have done with it. But mostly we just have post holes. So we can see that they built this thing that's called Woodhenge, which is just like Stonehenge, but with big wood poles for measuring the solstice, and we figure that those poles were probably decorated in some way, not like a totem pole, which is more of a West Coast style, but maybe covered in, you know, different kinds of baskets or painted in some way. I mean, it's interesting because the city really was built out of perishable material. And so what we look at are the layouts of the houses and kind of the burned remains of their offerings to the gods.
We're learning about what was once a huge, complex medieval-era metropolis in the United States from Annalee Newitz. She visited the archaeological dig at the massive Native American city of Cahokia. So what do archaeologists speculate led to the city's decline less than 300 years after it was home to some 30,000 people?
It's the biggest mystery about the city, and it's what is so fascinating to me and the archaeologists who work on it. Why did people abandon this incredible city that had so many resources? And there are a number of theories or a number of hypotheses, and there's one that's pretty simple, which is that, you know, climate change affected their ability to feed everyone in the city. And there is evidence that there may have been droughts that would have really affected the crops. So that was probably going on for sure. But on top of that problem, it seems that there was some kind of violent political transformation late in the life of the city, where people had basically changed their relationship to the downtown area of the city. So Monk's Mound, the huge earthen pyramid that was at the center of the city, was at one time in the middle of a big open plaza, and it's assumed that people came to that plaza and had big public ceremonies and hung out and met their leaders, or at least saw their leaders at the top of the mound. But then late in the city's life, a huge fence is built around Monk's Mound and around some of the houses that presumably were next to it. And so it's as if the people who were the elites living on Monk's Mound were kind of worried that people might be coming to get them. So it's possible that that was a defensive perimeter because people in the city were starting to get pissed off at the people on the mound. And again, this is, you know, a hypothesis. We don't know for sure because there was no writing left behind. But what we do know is that after that fence was built, within a couple of decades, people stopped using Monk's Mound. In fact, they started throwing garbage into the area around Monk's Mound inside that fenced-in area, which again suggests that people may have been rejecting whatever that mound had represented. And about half the population of the city just kind of leaves around that point. So something happened. There was some change in the relationship with power in the city. And we also, at that point, see Woodhenge torn down and an end to the human sacrifices that we believe happened early in the city's life. We have lots of evidence of human sacrifice, and it just completely stops at the point when people start to leave the city. So something changed, probably some kind of political shift, and then the city just slowly emptied out over the next century.
Well, I'm going to hone in on that human sacrifice, because there are other Central and South American people thought to have used ritualistic human sacrifice, like the Aztecs. But some historians have been skeptical of that and dismissed what were primarily European accounts of human sacrifice, you know, as antiquated or a stereotype. What's the evidence of human sacrifice in Cahokia?
So one thing I would point out is that we know that Europeans engaged in human sacrifice right around the same time that the Cahokians did. We had things like public executions, there were crusades. So this is kind of a medieval thing that happens both in Europe and in the Americas. So the evidence that we have is from a mound that was opened up in the 1960s, and this was before the rules that were put in place where Native Americans needed to be notified that their ancestors were being dug up and that it needed to be done under the supervision of Native American groups. And so this kind of thing would not happen now, but it did happen in the 60s. And so what was discovered were several mass graves, one of which had 54 young women in it, and they appeared to have been, you know, killed all at the same time and laid out in a very beautiful, orderly way, along with a lot of other sacrificial items and gifts. There's also a famous burial right next to it in the same mound called the Birdman Burial, which was also some kind of theatrical sacrifice of a young man and a young woman, probably in a fertility ritual of some kind. And they're buried with tons of beads and weapon points and different kinds of very valuable items. So these were not prisoners that were being chucked away. These were people who were part of a sacrifice where, and you know, a sacrifice is where you give up things that you love and value to the gods. And so these were people who'd been sacrificed along with valued objects, which were buried in this mound. And so, again, without a time machine, we can't be sure what happened and how they were sacrificed and why. But we do know from chemical analysis of the bones in the teeth of the skeletons that most of these sacrifices were people who were local to the area, so probably from Cahokia or nearby towns. So it wasn't like they were enemies that were from far away. And again, you know, there are many communities in South America and Central America and North America where there were human sacrifice rituals, and this was just part of worshiping. And it would not have been considered horrific until maybe it was. And that's one of the questions that we have, is maybe if at the end of the life of the city, people started to say, hey, you know, the elites in the city are making us give up our daughters for sacrifice or give up our sons for sacrifice. And, you know, what the hell's going on with that? So there may have been a shift in feeling about how fair it was or how worshipful it was to do this. But we don't know that for sure. So it's just one idea among many. I think archaeologists are pretty satisfied that these were definitely human sacrifices.
Wow, so fascinating, this cosmology, all of these theories, but they are theories, but pretty well developed. So why do we not hear about this Cahokia city like we've heard of sites uncovered in, you know, caves in France or sites in Egypt or in Greece?
Well, that's another mystery. I think, you know, people really need to learn more about it. And this site was only turned into a World Heritage Site in the 1980s. So compared to some of these other sites in Europe, it's a relatively young site, but it's quite lovely. And it is true that school children in the St. Louis area all go visit it. But I've gotten a lot of emails since writing the article from people who grew up in the area saying, wow, they made us visit this as kids, but I had no idea that it was so cool. So I think that, you know, the more that people do go out and learn about it, I think the more they'll appreciate the greatness of Native American culture in this country and how basically when Europeans arrived, this country had been urban for a really long time. And we'd had a lot of great metropolises that were all across the country. And this was the biggest in the place that became the United States. But it's just one of many cities that Native Americans built and that the ancestors of today's Native Americans were constructing. And so it's just, I hope that this kind of history will really awaken people to understanding how cool it's been in this country for a really long time. And not just cool, but sophisticated and very well-developed civilization.
Annalee Newitz, she's founder of IO9 and tech culture editor for Ars Technica. That's where we found her story of joining a team of archaeologists to find answers about the lost city of Cahokia. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can find a link to read the article and take a look at the renderings of Cahokia. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Ten years ago, the demographics of New Hampshire and of Concord High School were almost identical, both 93% white. While that number has remained steady for the state, the capital city's high school has diversified in a big way. Today, more than 10% of the school's 1,600 students are or were refugees resettled from some 66 countries. Many are of color, the very populations that have been targeted by a spike in hate crime since the election of Donald Trump. Senior Renee Dutier is among the international students taking part in an initiative aimed at changing the way that they are seen and understood by their predominantly white peers. Word of Mouth's Jimmy Gutierrez went back to school to find out how it's working.
There's a new lesson plan at Concord High, and it couldn't have come at a better time.
Pretend it's not a microphone. It's talking. You do that so well. Do you want me to stand behind you?
I do, but I'll tell a microphone.
That's Anna Marie Di Pasquale. The kids call her Miss D, and Renee Dutier, a senior at the school. We're heading to a classroom as part of Miss D's newest project, Travel Around the World. The idea is simple. Ex-refugee students share their cultures and traditions firsthand.
What do you have prepared?
I want to talk about my lovely country and tell them about my culture, the school, the weather.
Presentations I checked included a tasting of carrot halwa, a surprisingly sweet Pakistani dessert, the story of struggle behind the Burundi flag. I even learned how to say, how are you?
Boni.
And I'm fine in Lingala.
No, malamu. No, malamu. Yeah.
I'll be the first to say that language can be tricky, something that Renee has had to master throughout her childhood. Born in the Democratic Republic of Congo, her parents fled war to Rwanda when she was 8. For the next 4 years, Rwanda was home. Then her house was intentionally set on fire with some family still inside. Neighbors helped everyone escape, but her parents were badly burned. After that, they moved to Uganda, and in 2012, they were resettled in Concord, New Hampshire. Renee, now 14, was fluent in trauma and 3 languages. Today, in her 4th language, she casually stands in front of 20 students talking all about Rwanda. She tells classmates how some of the schoolgirls have to shave their heads. She shares music and talks about the ultimate equalizer, food.
We have to buy a fresh chicken, like actually a fresh one that's the real chicken. So you have to kill it. You have to kill it and cook it.
I can't even kill like bugs and stuff.
Renee is an expert in everything that relates to her culture. We have so many students that are experts in their own experience, so why not share all that expertise in the classroom? And then it benefits the whole school.
Miss D has an over-caffeinated vibe that comes to life in her eyes. She says her role working with the refugee kids is to give voice to their needs. It's something she's been addressing since she started 6 years ago.
First couple months I was here, I went into the social studies classrooms and we talked about how do we move beyond stereotypes. We get to know each other. We share each other's stories.
That's the motivation for Be the Change, a student-led social club which brings refugee students and American students together to learn from each other. The club also speaks to Concord's transformation over the last 20 years as a resettlement site. In 1995, Concord schools were 97% white. Today, almost 20% of the district's students are non-white. While taking in refugees has always been contentious, a new tone was struck this past election season. Here's President-elect Trump at a rally last year in Keene, New Hampshire.
I'm putting the people on notice that are coming here from Syria as part of this mass migration, that if I win, they're going back. They're going back. I'm telling you. They're going back.
In the 10 days following Trump's election, the Southern Poverty Law Center reported close to 900 hate crimes, most coming in K-12 schools, colleges, and universities. With calls for closed borders and whispers of a Muslim registry, there are some students in the majority speaking up.
Instead of just seeing, like, Sana, one of our Muslim students, wearing her hijab and just making assumptions, when you actually learn about her culture and her religion, it's actually a lot different than how, you know, the media and, like, politics make it out to be.
That's Juliet Greenwood, a senior at the high school. Growing up in Concord, Juliet says she wasn't exposed to much diversity. As a 7th grader, she was invited to one of Miss D's multicultural events and for the first time found herself in the minority.
Nobody spoke any English, but I was trying really hard to entertain people, and that's when Miss D said that I would be a great social worker, and that was our first kind of interaction.
A few years later, as a sophomore, she experienced something in her lunchroom that took diversity from interesting to important.
I mean, it's noticeable in the cafeteria. The white students sit at tables, and then the Nepali students sit at tables, then the more African students sit at tables, and there were some pretty derogatory comments from my friend group, and I kind of separated myself.
Juliet says she confronted her friends and their language. Now she's one of the leaders of the Be the Change Club.
But I find my role is really helping the white community, the enormous white community at this school, use me as an example and to get the different like international students to see me as like an accepting white student and not one of the many that maybe aren't as accepting.
It was a matter of minutes before I ran into some of those not as accepting kids. In an empty hallway, a group of white boys at an open locker whistled and made monkey noises at Ms. D's Afro-Caribbean American intern, Kaylin, and myself. Kaylin didn't flinch. Later during the presentations, in front of multiple teachers and a reporter, a couple of fresh-faced white teen boys in polo hats mocked the club and their students standing only feet away. I asked Ms. D if this was the norm.
So I will say that for the most part, Concord High School is a super welcoming place. Today's an anomaly. You know, today today was an anomaly. And it was, today was just an anomaly. I think that's, education is the answer to everything.
Combating racism isn't the toughest thing Renee's ever faced. But when international students first arrive, struggle is common.
I didn't know where to go. I didn't know who to turn to. I didn't know nobody, matter of fact. I used to go home and feel so bad. I'll tell my parents, I'm like, I'm not going back to school. But they're like, well, you got to. Remember, back home, you didn't go to school. You got to go to school. You got to push yourself. So I kept pushing myself, and hey, look at me now.
There's a lot of tears in my office. I need to give them a space to make sure that they know that they're going to be okay. They will get the language, that people are going to love them and welcome them here. And this is their school.
While learning the language is a crucial point of entry, Ms. D tells me that there's also language that needs to be unlearned.
Because when I first arrived, same thing, that term refugee. Language is powerful, right? And I was like, what? You're not refugees anymore.
When you call some people, yes, it would be kind of like not cool to be called like that. But otherwise, hey, we are used to it. We like heard it over and over again. It's like a song in our ears.
Ms. D's current tour through the school has served almost as a PSA that the students from 66 different countries speaking 44 different languages are no longer refugees. This is their home. They're new Americans. It's also allowed her to indulge her own interests.
I love to travel. I love food. I love to learn new things.
I think we just figured out where travel around the world came from. You just wanted to travel cheap.
That's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. I don't have to deal with the jet lag. I get the same food. It's exactly right.
That's amazing.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Jimmy Gutierrez.
And we've posted a link to Anne Marie's Be the Change Club at Concord High. It's at wordofmouthradio.org, along with some instructions for reporting hate crimes that was put together by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Again, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Donald Trump's candidacy, conduct, and communication style are historically unprecedented. So the announcement that his wife, Melania, will not move directly into the White House after inauguration, and that his daughter, Ivanka, will have an office there, and that family members may sit in on cabinet meetings was not entirely surprising, and as it turns out, not unparalleled. Brady Carlson is Word of Mouth's presidential historian and author of Dead Presidents, joining us now from Wisconsin Public Radio to talk about presidential kids past who've worked in the White House. Brady, great to have you back.
Happy New Year, Virginia.
Well, Happy New Year to you. Of course, our democracy was based on this idea of rejecting power based on lineage. So did the framers address familial roles?
Well, they did it mostly through custom. I mean, they certainly were trying to avoid any comparisons to a monarchy. But because they were turning to the man who had the most civic virtue of anyone, George Washington, to be the first president of the United States, they left it up to him, saying he's going to have enough propriety to keep things on the up and up. George Washington, in fact, once considered adding a line to, I think it was his inaugural address, pointing out that he had no one to bequeath his job to since he had no children. He decided in the end maybe that wasn't the manliest phrase he could put into his speech, so he left it out. But it was this idea that he needed to make it clear that this was a job that was entrusted to a person, not something that a person could hand down. That said, we have had plenty of powerful political families in the United States. We've had the Bushes, the Tafts, the Roosevelts, the Clintons, and some of those families have put more than one of their members in or close to the White House.
Has there ever, though, been a law against nepotism?
Yes. In fact, there's one on the books now. It says, and I'll just quote it, a public official may not appoint, employ, promote, advance, or advocate for appointment, employment, promotion, or advancement in or to a civilian position in the agency in which he is serving or over which he exercises jurisdiction or control any individual who is a relative of the public official. And it specifies that the president is one of those officials who's not supposed to appoint relatives to any position that he or she controls. Now, some scholars point out that the Constitution outlines the president's powers to appoint, and that might actually trump the federal law. That was passed in 1967, and the story that's always been told about it was that it was passed in the aftermath of John F. Kennedy's assassination to keep out, say, his brother, Bobby Kennedy, who had served as his attorney general, and the then president at the time, Lyndon Johnson, didn't exactly get along with Bobby Kennedy. So it was kind of a way to twist the knife in their long-running feud.
Well, that was a brother, Bobby Kennedy and JFK. But how about kids? Are there kids who have worked for their father, since, of course, it was always fathers?
Yes. The most prominent example would be John Quincy Adams. He was one of John Adams' sons, and he had been promising to the point that when John Adams would travel for the many positions he held in the early days of the United States, that he would bring John Quincy along with him. Later, after he had studied at Harvard and sort of grown up, President George Washington named John Quincy Adams minister to the Netherlands at the time that his father, John Adams, was serving as vice president. Now, that in and of itself doesn't suggest nepotism necessarily, but John Adams did, when he was elected president, sent his son to represent the U.S. in Prussia. So he did give his son a government job. To be fair, John Quincy Adams was highly qualified and was an extremely talented diplomat. He would then go on to serve as Secretary of State and would later be elected president himself. In fact, one of the most qualified, if not the most qualified person ever elected president. There have been other examples over the years. Most of the time when a president's son or daughter works for a president, it's in a role of kind of like a private secretary or an aide, not necessarily an official job title. One example is President Rutherford B. Hayes' son, Webb, who was his father's private secretary in the White House. He would go on to become kind of an amazing and unheralded American figure. He was a prominent businessman and then decided to give all of that up to become a soldier, and had become kind of, his exploits are kind of fun and kind of wild to read about. Imagine a CEO leaving the boardroom and then becoming kind of a soldier of fortune, almost an Indiana Jones type. He would go on to win the Medal of Honor and have some really thrilling exploits. Then after he retired, he went on to build a presidential library. It was the first public presidential library.
Okay, so that's Webb Hayes, Rutherford B. Hayes' son. Have there been others like John Quincy Adams, who of course became president, who went on to other government roles?
Yeah, I would say the most prominent example of that is not necessarily a government role, but a military role. Theodore Roosevelt Jr. Imagine being Theodore Roosevelt Jr., right? I mean, that, in fact, he would speak oftentimes about, there's no way that a person in my position could ever live up to his name with a father like Theodore Roosevelt. But he did give it a great try. He was in the military. He fought in a number of wars and ended up as a brigadier general in World War II. In fact, he was the first general to land during D-Day. He was on Utah Beach. Is this 57-year-old man standing there on the beach, directing troops with his cane and really rallying people to move toward the German positions. The thing is, he was literally having a heart attack at the time and wound up dying about a month later. Omar Bradley, who is another famous World War II general, was asked, what was the most heroic thing you saw in the war? And he answered immediately, he said, Theodore Roosevelt at Utah Beach.
Wow. We've talked so far about sons, but there have been some particularly strong bonds between presidents and daughters, some even serving almost in a first lady-like capacity, as it's suspected Ivanka Trump might.
Just by way of context, it's not necessarily strange for someone other than the president's wife to serve as first lady. I mean, an example of that goes back to when Thomas Jefferson was president. His wife had died years before he was elected. So his daughter would sometimes serve as the social hostess of the White House. Sometimes his friend James Madison's wife, Dolly, who became the model for the position that eventually became called First Lady, would fill in and serve that. And a number of presidents had been in similar situations. So it's not necessarily an unusual thing, though it is less usual in modern times. Really, since Eleanor Roosevelt, the job of First Lady has been more formalized. The First Lady has her own staff and things like that. But really, like anything else surrounding the president, the role of what it's like to be a presidential family member is something we've been sorting out over time. A great example of a daughter who was influential or played an important role in a presidency was Franklin Roosevelt's daughter, Anna. Now, Franklin Roosevelt had Eleanor Roosevelt as his first lady, and she was off traveling the country and really had her own career, her own sphere of influence. But inside the White House, Anna Roosevelt was often seen as the go-to person. If you needed to get to the president, she was the intermediary. She didn't have a formal role. She wasn't the president's secretary or an aide or anything like that. She was really just off the books in a way. But in the last few years of his presidency, she was as involved in his day-to-day affairs as pretty much anyone else.
We're talking with Brady Carlson. He's author of the book Dead Presidents and our, let's say, presidential historian. We're talking about some of the roles that first family members have played historically in other presidencies. Brady, we're talking about some family members, sons, daughters, who have served their fathers during their presidency. Others who have not had such a cozy relationship with dad in the White House?
Yeah, others have had a hard time figuring out if my dad is the president. You know, that's sort of like having a supernova in your life, this immense figure who is the center of attention everywhere he goes. And how do you develop your own identity when you've got that in your life? In recent years, some of Ronald Reagan's children were growing up in public, so to speak, and would sometimes say oppose their own father's policies in the news while he was in office. Some of Ronald Reagan's kids were growing up in public in a way when he was president and were sometimes, say, publicly at odds with his positions while he was president. And then George H.W. Bush, who was Reagan's successor, the government sued his son Neil and Neil's company during the savings and loan crisis. That was while Bush was president. He said as a father it was difficult, but as a president it wasn't something he was going to be involved with because he was going to steer clear of that. But you have to think that was pretty awkward.
Right. Do you have a favorite presidential spawn?
It has to be Alice Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt's oldest daughter, who
so
was...
So glad you said that. I've read about her. She just sounds like quite a character.
Well, I mean, this comes back to that idea of how do you become yourself when you've got a president for a father? And Alice succeeded beyond anyone's expectations. She just said, I'm going to do what I want. I mean, all of the Roosevelt kids were pretty wild. They were running all over the place and were bringing exotic pets into the White House. Alice had a snake. That was her contribution. But she would smoke on the roof of the White House and she would liven up parties. If she thought things were getting kind of dull, she would just fire a pistol into the air to wake people up. And after the Roosevelts left the White House, she stayed in Washington, D.C. She had married a prominent politician at the time and became sort of the go-to political slash social figure for decades. She cultivated presidents and famous politicians and famous people and became just sort of a quotable person. There was a funny moment once where Lyndon Johnson came to see her and in her later years, Alice Roosevelt would wear this big hat and Johnson, who was president at the time, said, you know, when you're wearing that hat, Alice, it makes it hard for me to give you a kiss. She goes, Mr. President, why do you think I wear it? Her famous saying, of course, she loved political gossip, and her famous saying was, if you don't have anything nice to say about someone, sit right here by me. That's sort of the most famous Alice quote. And she lived into her 90s and had, even by American political standards, an incredibly unique life.
So though she was unique, it is not so singular for the child of a president to serve close to him. But I really can't help but wonder what the framers would think of someone called Barron living in the White House.
It is such an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, the presidency itself has changed in so many ways from what was originally envisioned by the framers. They really thought of it as a sort of a CEO job. That was the person who's going to implement things that the really powerful people, Congress, did. And it wasn't necessarily going to be the fixture of American political life that it has become. And not just in political terms either. I mean, the president is a cultural figure as much as he is a political figure. There's so much then that comes with that. I mean, you have exhibits at the Smithsonian about the dresses that the wives of presidents wear, and you have books written about what the children of presidents do, not necessarily because they're doing anything that the rest of us don't do, but because their dad is the president. And so that becomes a component of our cultural life in a really interesting way. But I think to the broader question, since Barron can mean multiple things, what about having a real estate Barron as the next president? And that's going to be an interesting question. You know, the people who don't like the president-elect say that he's a demagogue and that the framers tried to build a system to block demagogues from becoming president. Then again, a lot of people can point to the new president's wealth and say, well, George Washington was the first president and at the time was probably the richest or close to the richest man in America. So look, our political system is full of surprises, and it's going to be interesting to see how this surprise plays out.
It is indeed. And Brady, we'll keep turning to you. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Brady Carlson, he is a host and reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio and author of Dead Presidents, an American adventure into the strange deaths and surprising afterlives of our nation's leaders. Much more on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. If you like what you heard, we invite you to share stories and segments with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of our archives to listen to. You can post them on social media or email them to friends. And let us know what you are hearing from your circle of friends and colleagues and sources. What are you curious about? What are you finding interesting? Or what is scratching at your sense of wonder? We find that the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. Please keep sharing them and join us again for Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.